Hello and welcome back to another episode of A Life Economy, dedicated to exploring the intersection of technology, spirituality, and consciousness. I'm your host, Cosmo Scharf, and on today's episode, we are joined by Claudia Muhlenweg. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me. I'm super excited to be here.
Awesome, absolutely. So Claudia is a natural eyesight improvement coach and the founder of Holistic Vision, where she helps people correct and improve their vision without the need for glasses and contacts. So this is something that is very interesting to me personally, as someone that has worn glasses for about half of my life, or you know, maybe about a decade or so. It has been something that, you know, that's part of my life for quite a long time. And of course, my first question for you is, you know, what's the deal with glasses and contacts? Why? Or how is it even possible to correct our vision without these tools?
So that's a great question. There's a lot of questions embedded in your question. Mm. So the first thing with glasses and contacts is that they're basically a band-aid. They don't address the root cause of your blurry vision. So let's say you break a leg, right? And you would get a cast. And then the doctor would be like, you know what? You have to wear that for the rest of your life. And it would probably get thicker and, you know, and you'll be like, no, that doesn't make any sense. So when we have blurry vision, it could be many causes. It's based on strain, and strain can be a mental strain, a physical strain, an emotional strain. And glasses are basically a crutch or contacts or LASIK that doesn't actually address the real reason your vision got blurry. And most people will attest that make it worse in the long term. In fact, you know, usually the vision doesn't get better when you start wearing glasses.
Right. Yeah, I can attest to that as well. I've increased my prescription maybe once or twice, and I've noticed a decline in my eyesight, which is in part, you know, one of the reasons why I reached out to you and started to work with you, because this idea of not having to rely upon some external device, whether it's glasses, contacts, LASIK, or you know, whatever, to have incredible eyesight is a really appealing idea to me. And of course, I would imagine anyone who has a number of issues with their vision. And so I'm curious, first of all, you know, the scope of the issue globally, as well as why this method of improving your eyesight without the need for glasses or contacts is not so well known.
You always bundle so many questions into one, but let me start with it. So this is a great question, because there is an increasing trend of nearsightedness. And that's, we see that all over the world. When we look at statistics, like in the 70s, it was about 25% of people were nearsighted, right? Myopic. And now in the US, it's about 42%, and the trend is rising. And that's counting adults, children, like everybody.
42%.
But when you look at Asia, it's way more alarming. When you look, for instance, at Singapore, they had the same, about 25% in the 70s. And now over 90%.
No way.
Of children and young people in Singapore are nearsighted.
Wow.
In China, it's about somewhere in the 80%. Yes. So, and that's not genetic, right? Genetics don't. They don't work that fast. That takes several generations. So it's definitely lifestyle, environmental factors, and yeah, what we're going to talk about today.
Sure. Well, that is quite stunning. So you're saying 90%, sorry, in what country?
Singapore.
Wow, that's fascinating and really alarming. And I'm curious, are you aware of how far back those statistics go? Like, you know, say 100 years ago, like, do we have information on that are a little bit earlier, so we can get a broader context for how our vision has changed?
I don't know. 100 years ago, I looked at the Lancet. I look at statistics all the time, and sometimes it's hard because, like, say the US, right? We only have the data on the general population for nearsightedness. We don't have just children, versus in Singapore and in Southeast Asia in general, there's more focus on the children because they already have such high rates of myopia at such young ages. And there's a higher risk of eye disease later in life. So there's more concern, you know. So there's, unfortunately, when I prepared this, it's really hard to find statistics that are equally done in each country, right? Versus
Right, you know, sure, yeah. To make that comparison. And for mm-hmm. people that might not know what myopia is that just nearsightedness?
Yeah, and this is also a great question. So nearsightedness, and I just had a student that people confuse this all the time. So when you're nearsighted, you see the near point really well. You can read without glasses, maybe. Like that's what you have, right?
Yeah.
But then the distance vision is blurry. And then farsighted or presbyopic. Presbyopic is a form of farsightedness that's also called old age sight, or you need reading glasses, you know, typical like mid-40s. That's when your distance vision is good. Great, right? You have distance vision, but the closer it gets, the blurrier it gets. And those rates are also increasing rapidly.
Hmm. Yeah, that's very alarming. I mean, that 90% figure, you know, vision is an incredibly important aspect of who we are. And to think that such a large percentage of our population has significant issues with their vision is scary. And I'm curious, you know, as someone who specializes in alternative forms of treatment for vision health, I guess in that, like, why do you think we're dealing with such widespread issues with our health for our eyes?
Again, great question. And, you know, in the past, actually when Dr. Bates created this method over 100 years ago, you know, that was already in the early 20th century, right? People thought, oh, it's too much time at the near point, right? In fact, they invented devices like metal braces that kids couldn't, like, that they had to keep a certain distance from the book and they couldn't drop to. And then they found that that wasn't really the problem. However, nowadays, we spend way more time at the near point than we used to 100 years ago, right? It's not just books. It's especially digital devices. And in Asia, what I also see, so there's several factors. Definitely how much time you spend at the near point. Our eyes are not meant to be locked into one distance. They're meant to constantly move, shift focus, near far, peripheral vision, all that stuff. The second thing, and this is especially true for Asia, it's like the mental strain or the mental pressure, like, right, our central nervous system, it's all regulated in the brain. And when you are mentally stressed or strained or worried or anxious or any kind of negative emotion, that puts you in the fight or flight mode. So you're in that stress mode, too much cortisol, like your whole body is, the pupils dilate. You're in that stress mode and that triggers down into everything in your body, your digestion, everything. And so in Asia, especially, there's a huge, and even here now, right, there's a high pressure on children to succeed in school. Like when I was little, I mean, I was born in the early 60s. We were like, okay, you do your homework, you're done in half an hour, you play outside until the streetlights come on, right? Now I see these children like studying, and then extracurricular activities. And one last thing I want to say, studies in England and Australia have shown that sunlight exposure is super important. So when children that play 2 or more hours outside each day, and it doesn't even have to be sunny as long as it's natural daylight, versus those that are inside all day, have a way lower rate of nearsightedness. So they believe that the sunlight stimulates dopamine receptors in your retina that help your eyeball grow to the proper like length. Because you might know in nearsightedness, the eyeball is elongated. And there's animal studies that confirm the same thing I can talk more about. But yeah, so there's several reasons. This is the near point. Wow. It's the mental pressure and it's the lack of natural light.
So it's not any singular factor. It's the combination of those three things that you just mentioned that results in the issues that we have. That makes sense. And I can relate to that. I mean, I would go, you know, we'd have recess and, you know, have play, you know, go to the playground when I was a kid. But I don't really recall spending a significant amount of time outside growing up. And then also what I do remember for sure was just spending a lot of time on the computer playing video games. You know, starting from really elementary school all the way on upwards, and the amount of screen time only continued to increase to the point where, you know, if I could see a time lapse of my whole life from beginning to where I am now, I would imagine an alarmingly large amount of time of that would just be me just like this, you know, staring at a screen. And, you know, of course I'm getting stuff done and I'm like learning and I'm reading and doing work. But at the same time, it's like so much of just this one activity that I'm sure many people can relate to, of just, you know, staring at a screen, whether it's the laptop or the iPad or the phone. What are some strategies for people that are, you know, essentially, you know, their job or their career is to essentially get paid to stare at screens? What are some ways that they can alleviate some of that stress on their eyes and start to improve their health?
So, good question. And screens, particularly, people stop blinking. And blinking is one of the simplest things, like breathing, that we do automatically. But we also have a control. And I noticed earlier mm-hmm. when we do the pre-check, you know, you were looking at the screen and you weren't blinking for almost a minute. And I noticed that with gamers, I observed gamers. And that split second when you might miss, like, you know, I don't know, my kids play, like, what is it called? Call of Duty or something. Where you miss some kind of sharpshooter or something. Right. Exactly. That nanosecond. And so blinking, I actually have a friend who just passed away at 101 years old. Not from COVID, but he died. He was 101. Never wore glasses, always had perfect vision. He blinked every second. And I recommend every 2 to 3 seconds. Mm-hmm. That lubricates your eyes. Lots of people say that the eyes are dry, but it also prevents, and you talked about staring. So staring is a bad habit. Like, you know, staring like deer in the headlights, staring will make your vision blurry. And blinking is kind of like that little computer restart where the second you blink, you wouldn't stare. Your eyes are kind of, you know, they keep moving. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like,
sure.
So that's like a super simple strategy. Obviously, the other thing that I see, that people develop a kind of a tunnel vision, especially when they wear glasses or look at screens. Good vision is the combination of central clarity or central focus, which is super small. This blew my mind when I first learned this. It's the size of a pinhead. Is your perfect clarity. If I look at your right eye, I see your left, everything else is not as sharp, because our anatomy in the retina can only see the fovea, in the macula is where we see perfectly sharp. It's a tiny spot. The rest is, you know, near periphery, middle, like, of course, the outer periphery is blurrier than the near periphery. And so I see that problem, that people kind of, like, when I used to work in an office, you would walk to somebody's desk and you stand next to them and they like don't even see you, especially when they have headphones. And then you're like, hey, oh, like, you know, like they literally have blinders on. So that's important, stimulating your peripheral vision. And then also just looking up, like I have my computer set up where I just look up and I'm looking into my backyard. Like I don't have to get up. And so you want to make sure you shift your focus a lot.
I'm curious about that specifically. Say I'm working for an hour, and is there a certain amount of time that you would recommend to take breaks in between to readjust your vision and where you're looking?
There's all kinds of rules. I mean, I've heard the 20-20-20 or the... I'm not really a fan of these rules, because let's face it, like, who's going to set a timer? I mean, but yeah, I look around all the time. I mean, I look in my camera now, which makes it look like I'm looking at you. But when I actually look at you, I'm not looking at the camera, but I shift my focus around all the time. So I don't like to set a timer, but if you want, I mean, every 5 minutes, I would definitely, or if you read a book, you know, you can put a bookmark in there, or, you know, if you read on a Kindle or something, you can say after the end of the page, I'm looking up, you know, definitely as much as possible.
This phenomenon of glasses and the idea of maybe glasses are not the best tool to assist with our vision is very interesting and in a subversive way, because it's essentially taken for granted that, you know, if you have any kind of problem with your vision, you just go to the eye doctor, they'll give you glasses, and then you wear glasses, and now that's what you do, and you wear them for the rest of your life, or you wear contacts, and then maybe ultimately you get LASIK or something else like that is a little bit more permanent, although it's not quite permanent, because as I've heard you describe, it doesn't, you know, last forever, and you have to get it done or your vision continues to decline. But I'm curious, assuming that it truly is possible to correct and improve your vision without the need for glasses or contacts or any of these other tools, why is this not common knowledge? Why are glasses so prevalent? Is it a matter of the business that people are getting paid? The doctors and you know, eye doctors and people that produce sunglasses. Like, I'm curious why we're not just taught how to improve this without the need for those other devices.
That's a really, like, I agree. Like, why do we not know? So Dr. Bates, who was kind of the pioneer, the founder of natural vision improvement, right? He was an ophthalmologist. He died in 1930. So he was practicing in the 19th century, in the 20th, professor at Columbia. He was curious because he noticed some of his patients, their vision improved. You know, it just got better. He's like, hold on, like, I wasn't taught in optometry school, in ophthalmology school, that this can happen. So he was like the researcher, and he worked on himself and lots of hundreds of students and thousands of people. And he recognized, before we had neuroscience, he recognized that vision is really 90% brain and 10% eyeball. I actually see in my webinars, I always say, like, jokingly, you know, write down, I do not see with my eyes. Because the seeing, the act of seeing happens in the visual cortex in your brain. And the eyes, and I give you a really fascinating example. So they did studies with people that have, it's called dissociative identity disorder. It used to be called multiple personality disorder. So those people have different alters or personas, up to six different ones. And so they did three different studies and looked at the different, the vision and the different alters. And people could have like minus three diopter in one persona, and they could have 20/15 in another. And even the pupil That's size, crazy. The color perception, the eye pressure was different. And if this is the same physical body, or like when you take drugs, like you know, you take any psychedelic drugs, you see things that are not there and vice versa. So it's the brain where you actually see and perceive versus the eyes. And of course, the eyes have to be healthy, right? I mean, if you cut the optic nerve or something, or if you like think of a light bulb and then the brain and right, the plug is the retina and then the cable is the optic nerve. So of course, if you cut that, nothing, you know, nothing gets sent to the brain, right? So there has, of course, the physical parts have to be healthy, but you don't see with your eyes. Your eyes don't see anything.
Yeah, so the brain is what puts together the information received by the eyes into a coherent image, so we have a model of what is going on in the world so we can operate within it. That be accurate?
Yeah, and you can trick the brain really easily, like all the visual illusions, and you know, the brain uses contrast to compare. Or you know, those drawings on the sidewalk where people do with crayons, whatever, and it looks like it's a canyon at a certain angle, so it looks 3D. You know, those things. Yeah, I mean, the brain can be easily tricked. Also, it's really all like Bates called it, like what we see is not what we actually see. It's our mind's interpretation of what we think we see.
Yes, that is so accurate. And yeah, all it takes is to see one really good optical illusion to start to understand that what we perceive isn't necessarily the objective truth, and that reality is way more, I guess, blurry would be maybe one way of putting it, or not as...
I think more individual. Yeah,
individualized, for sure. And it's not something that you can just kind of grab onto as and say that it's any one thing. It's all in the way that we perceive it to be. So it's heavily dependent on the individual person and their physiology and what's going on in their brain.
And their attention. I mean, you know, the old saying, like, don't see the forest for the trees. I mean, where do we put our attention? Are we curious about something? And I wanted to talk a little bit, you talked about gaming and, you know, so there is a tendency for nearsighted people, and I don't like generalizations, but in general, there is a more of a tendency to be introverted. So introverted kids also got rewarded for reading books, right? Like, oh, you're so good. You're reading books. And the kid that was outside playing and shooting arrows, you know, was kind of like not as good of a kid. So, you know, in a way, the personality can also be a contributor. And in a way, kids often get rewarded for doing things that are where it's more the introvertedness, being in their bubble. Like, so that is also adding to the whatever you already have a tendency to do, or personality, or like, you know, how do you see yourself? How do you, it's not just how you see the world, but how do you see others seeing? Like, are you even ready to have others look at you? Right. It's a way bigger thing.
And that brings up this concept of vision being something that is not necessarily just about eye health or the brain, but you know, more in the, I want to say metaphorical sense, but, or just maybe in a larger context, right? Where we have this phrase of 2020 vision. And of course, this year has been quite bizarre and probably nowhere near what we expected. I know that there was potentially some special emphasis placed on the year because of the digits, right, and what they represent in our culture. So I'm curious what your expectations were going into this year with that number in mind, and how it has lived up to, or maybe not lived up to, your expectations around this concept of 2020 vision.
So 2020, it's interesting how many, we actually, the Vision Teacher Association, we actually produced a documentary that's coming out this fall called Vision 2020. And, you know, and I suddenly saw that pop up everywhere, like everybody. So to me, that's why I like to say vision, even though when people Google, they say eyesight. So for SEO, I used to eyesight, right? But I like vision because it's the bigger encompassing factor than eyesight. Eyesight is part of vision. And yes, 2020, in terms of expectations, you know, I don't have so much expectations as goals. And my goal is to reach 1 million people with this message that you can improve your eyesight naturally. And also that vision is related, or eyesight is related to your life vision, how you see yourself. What is the, like, what do you want to create in the world? Like, what is your purpose, your mission in the world? Like, you know, and a lot of my students are like in retirement or in the transition to retirement. I'm like, how is, now that you don't have a job anymore or a business, how is that changing your, like, what do you live for every day? What do you get up for every day, right? So for me, I think 2020 will be a year that really is about clarity of, like, where are we going as a society, right? Like, some people put blindness on it, like, oh no, I don't hear, like, it's all good, we are perfect, you know, like, those people will stay in the blur, right? That are pretending everything is great. And yeah, we have this little pandemic, but that's going to pass and everything will be as it was. It will never be as it was. Like, that's a complete illusion. And I think we are at the tipping point of society where, you know, we can either blossom into a brand new society on all these levels or not. So I think this is a really, that's basically my mini version without getting into political.
No, I totally agree with you. Yeah. This is something we talk about. We've had many conversations in past episodes about, you know, the pandemic and what's going on in the broader context of the world, and looking for those positive opportunities to see beyond just this, all the doom and gloom and negativity and fear, and see how, well, first of all, to acknowledge that it does exist, that it is a real thing that we are dealing with, that there is trauma that has been going on and is going on currently that needs to be resolved, and we're in the process of healing, but also to have that, ultimately, that positive vision of the future that we can promote and hold on to as something that we care about, that we value, a healthier planet and healthier bodies and improved vision, as, you know, being a kind of a critical part of that for sure. And I'm curious, just going back to you were mentioning something about stress and vision, and that's a very interesting idea to me, because I don't know if I ever really thought about it, but I guess I always assumed that, you know, bad eyesight was just something that sort of just happened because there's some defect with the eye or something. Just, I don't know. I never really kind of questioned why it happened. Like, maybe there's just some defect and, oh, okay, now I'm getting glasses, I guess. So I'd love for you to thread that connection between our environment and the mental and emotional states and our vision, because it sounds like they're connected, but I'm curious where that connection, if you could kind of provide more detail on really how that works.
Yeah, so I'm especially with nearsightedness, right? When, I don't know, when you got your glasses, you said you had them half your life, yeah, and you had them for 10 years. So I'm like, are you 20 years old?
No, I'm 25.
But basically, you know, okay, when did you get your glasses?
I got them in 8th grade when I was maybe, I think I was 13.
Okay. So then I would be like, okay, what was going on in your life when you were like 10, 11, 12?
Well,
like, what happened?
You know, it's funny because I think I started to make this connection when I first started to talk with you, and then just reaffirming it or remembering it a few days ago, which is so obvious now. But in 8th grade, so there were, you know, it was middle school. There were two main groups of students that would go to all the classes together throughout the day. And first day of school in 8th grade, I saw up on the board that all three of my best friends were in one class and I was in one class. And I was just like totally devastated by this. And the whole year was just really clouded by that separation between my friends and I. And it really affected me emotionally negatively. And it, you know, that was the same year that I started to notice that I couldn't see the board. And I never really made that connection between those two events until pretty recently. And I suppose that, you know, there's some part of me that was protecting me or not wanting to see something, not wanting to face the reality of my situation or being in resistance to this separation instead of just accepting it. Because for the longest time, I was like, maybe I can switch classes. Maybe, you know, I mean, I hope we'll still be friends. But yeah, I mean, it was a tough time for me. So I see that there's something in that circumstance that affected my biology that created a downstream effect that affected my vision. And then I got glasses and that kind of manifested even further reliance on, or rather further my vision.
So yeah, basically what, and you know, yours was probably a milder case even. I mean, I have students that had severe trauma as a child, right? But it's usually referred to as adverse childhood events. And knowing that good vision is based on relaxation, and if you just look at the physiology, like the nervous, you can only relax when the body and the brain basically says we are safe. The second you're anywhere where you don't feel safe for whatever reason, you're kind of on alert. You're not relaxed. So you probably didn't feel safe without your friends, and you are always in that kind of stress mode the whole time. Meaning, and when we are in what's known as fight or flight mode or sympathetic nervous system state, you know, like I said earlier, your pupils dilate, your peripheral vision shuts down. It's like you're ready, you're in action to like run or fight or whatever. And it's not always that extreme case, where the tiger is coming at you. But it can be this subtle chronic stress that, you know, and then the emotional stuff. And then usually it's like, oh, you're going to be fine. And then usually you're invalidated as a kid and your parent. I have two daughters. You know, we did our best as parents. It's like, you know, you can't blame them or the teachers. And then what happens? You can't see the blackboard. And in the unified school district, the public schools, the teacher is mandated, at least here in California, to tell this parents to get the kids' glasses. Wow. And if I have some parents that contact me, and if they don't, they can be actually kicked out of the school. And what happens is the eyeball is not actually too long yet right? It's just what's called pseudomyopia. It's like your brain, when you're in that fight or flight mode, you literally, you want to be in that little bubble, you're in that little cocoon. You literally don't want to see the world out there because you don't feel safe. Like you want to, you're right, your body or your brain is trying to protect you, like you said, right? From experiencing all this stuff that stresses you out more. And then once you get the glasses, and this is where the animal experiments I want to talk about really quickly. So they did some animal experiments with chickens, monkeys, and frogs. And the chickens had the biggest change, but they all had the same reaction. So what they did several things. One, they put occluders, like blocks on the chicks on one eye. And like that's where the sunlight studies came in also. So that eye grew too long. So it became nearsighted. The eye that didn't get any light. That confirmed the studies with the children playing outside in the sunlight and that. The other tests they did, they put some -10 or -15, I don't remember, and some chicks got plus lenses. And the eyes that got the minus lens, the eyeball also grew too long so that the chicks could see clearly, right? So the eyeball adjusted to the lens, and the same when they got the plus lenses, which is for farsightedness like readers, the eyeball grew too short. So the body of the animals adjusted the eyes so that they can still see clearly. And when they removed the lenses, the eyeball grew back. So they haven't done studies on humans for obvious reasons. It's not like, okay, let's test it on children. But, you know, mammals, like the monkeys, had the same reaction. And we're not that different. So instead of addressing the emotional root cause that should, you know, basically the glasses are the crutch. And then the strain doesn't go away. Right. Your emotional stress doesn't go away. And,
right?
So, right.
For sure. Yeah, exactly. It fits within a broader pattern that I can apply to most aspects of society, which is addressing the symptoms and not the root cause. Because it's always easier to identify and solve for the symptoms, and probably more lucrative, because so long as we're continually fixing just the symptoms and not the root cause, then people are always going to be in a state of stress or trauma and not ever actually resolve the trauma. And I'm thinking of eye doctors, and it's interesting because, you know, you would think that let's say their objective is to help people improve their vision, right? That's the goal of an eye doctor, I would say, not being an eye doctor, but that's what I imagine. That's what I, you know, that's what I imagine. So they're prescribing people contacts and glasses, but if they really are just merely crutches or like a wheelchair for your eyes and not getting to the root cause of changing it from the bottom up, then it doesn't really seem like that they're really effectively achieving their purpose.
I fully agree with you, and I think we also have to differentiate between ophthalmologists, and they mostly about eye diseases and surgeries and that stuff. And I think I just want to make sure that everybody gets that I'm not totally against allopathic medicine, that I think there's a certain reason and a necessity for certain things in surgeries. And so I'm not saying that sometimes the combination of both is really good. However, optometry is really based on a 200-year-old model by Heinrich Helmholtz, who was a German physician. And they still believe, like they still use this old model, completely ignoring neuroscience, which has really shown the neuroplasticity the last, 30 years. We know that the brain can be trained, and they still treat the eye as if it's like not, you know, as if you can kind of, I have a little eyeball here in my drawer, right? As if you can just kind of, okay, here's Cosmo's eye. Let's look at this eyeball as if it's not attached to everything else, you know? So that's the thing. And I give you another example that blows my mind. So an optometrist named Elliot Forrest, he did all this research in the 80s, noticing that the astigmatism is a certain, so where your cornea isn't dome shaped like a basketball slice, right? But it's more like an American football. There's a steeper angle, and the cornea is based. So basically, the axis of your astigmatism indicates the angle that where the cornea is kind of not shaped properly. And he noticed that there's a correlation to people's habit, like their eye movements, their head movements, and their posture. So people that always have a tilt, or people that have several monitors and they always glance over, but they don't move their head along. He was like an 85% accuracy. And I can now look at prescriptions and say the same thing. What habits, like, for instance, people that wear readers often look over their eyes, over the glasses, so they don't move their head with the eyes. But no optic. So this is now established research. They did studies with orchestra musicians and found that violinists who always have a head tilt, or if you're in an orchestra and you always look on the right and you share a music stand with a colleague, that, you know, a trombone player that has the head tilted, they always end up with the same astigmatism. But no optometrist ever tells you about this stuff. I'm like, how can they not be interested in learning the new science? How do they still, you know, I think it's so ingrained in our brains because they don't improve your vision. They give you a crutch. It's like, okay, you're bleeding. Let's put a Band-Aid on that. That's
right. That really, right? It bothers me that it really didn't even cross my mind until, you know, I listened to a podcast similar to the one we're doing right now that they were talking about the Bates method. I'm like, well, I've never heard of that. And did a little bit more research. And I mean, it's really fascinating stuff. And yeah, I never questioned for a moment that it might be possible to improve my eyesight in another way, or to even really make the connection between what I was dealing with at school and my mental and emotional state and my vision. No one told me that. The eye doctor didn't tell me that. It's interesting. It's like I'm imagining, you know, the skills of people in that position in the future should be able to engage people in those kinds of conversations and not just, you know, examining the eyeball as it's some distinct separated piece of your biology.
Yeah. I think it's also because of this time slots that, you know, people, that doctors give. And I mean, I don't want to blame all the optometrists in our Vision Teacher Association. We have several optometrists. Jacob Lieberman is an example who cured his own myopia. He wrote a lot of books also about sunlight, which is a whole other topic, why sunlight is actually good for the eyes. And so there is a few, you know, Sam Byrne, Mark Roseman, there's a few optometrists or holistic doctors that have recognized that what they were taught is really just a way to formulate a crutch. And, you know, there's a lot of people who want that crutch. It's the same, you know, I always say I work with nutrition also. Some people just want to take metformin for diabetes instead of actually looking at their diet. So my mission is to that the world knows this is an option. Mm-hmm. So you have the choice, right? LASIK is irreparable damage to your cornea that often leaves you with dry eyes and halos. You cannot fix it. It's done. It's, you know, and only lasts 10 years, oftentimes less. So, but you know, people make their own choices. It's, I'm not saying if you don't want to get LASIK, then get LASIK, but get informed, read the like 20-page small print that you're signing, right? And if you want glasses, just know that it's not going to make your vision better. What else do I want to say? One last thing, you might have heard of Susan Berry. She wrote a book called Fixing My Gaze. And she's a neurobiologist or scientist, but she had a problem where her eyes wouldn't work together. So she had strabismus, right? Her eyes would go in and out. And they surgically corrected it so that the eyes look cosmetically pretty, look straight. But she said, if only the ophthalmology department that did the surgery and the optometry, that's behavioral optometry, that's another form where they usually work with children, help you move your eyes together, like fusion, binocular vision. If they would have talked to each other, she never had depth perception. So she used that eye or that eye, but they never worked together. And she's thought like in her 50s, she's like, I was taught if you don't get that by age 3, it's like too late, right? You're doomed. So she found a vision therapist who was willing to work with her, took her over a year, and she needed some glasses to help her, you know. And she has a TED talk about it too, how she, the first time she saw the steering wheel pop out at her. So she looked up in the sky, it was snowing and it was all 3D. And she's like, this makes no sense from what I was taught and what I know now about the brain, you know. But, you know, so there is a lot, if you look, there's so much research out there proving all this. But I think and it's very lucrative, like you said. I think optometrists, You know, you can also Google that. They make sure that you wear contacts and glasses because it's more profitable. And I think they will have to look. Zenni, you know, the website like zenni.com where you can order glasses right. really cheap for like $10 without a prescription. I think more and more people will actually, you know, it might take another 100 years, but more people will recognize that they yeah, were kind of cheated.
Shout out to Zenni. Thank you for that recommendation. These are the ones that I went with. They're glow in the dark. They're quite fun. And I was stunned to see the prices on some of those glasses compared to, you know, Warby Parker's nice or, you know, whoever else is out there, you know, glasses costing, you know, $100, $200, $300. And these are like $20, or you can get ones for like literally like $5. And it's just order of magnitude cheaper.
Yeah. And, you know, progressive, once you get into you're 25, but once you get into your 50s, a lot of times, you know, people have no clarity at any distance. And then you get those progressives that cause astigmatism and postural problems. But they're like $700, $800.
That's crazy.
Right? Yeah.
I want to talk to you about indoor lighting as it relates to vision. And this has been a pet peeve of mine ever since I really started to understand it or perceive it, which is just poor lighting conditions in restaurants or in department stores or even, you know, in my own apartment, that it just this sickly kind of green bluish color, or it's dim, and just I get so frustrated sometimes when I like walk by a restaurant. I'm like, how could they choose this lighting in there? It looks absolutely miserable to be inside this restaurant. I'm curious, is this something that you notice? And what are some ways that we can be picking the what kind of lighting we choose for our homes and living spaces?
So I'm not, even though I'm a former graphic designer, I'm definitely not a lighting designer when it comes to like what light is pretty. What I do want to say is that the sunlight, which is the best natural, it's just the best light. It has the full spectrum. It has a lot of blue, actually. So in our macula, a healthy macula is covered with lutein and zeaxanthin, and we absorb about 60% of the blue light. And we have pupils that get really small and bright light, right? So however, so if you want to work, if you want a work a desk light, I like the Ott lights, that where it's John Ott did all this research on light. He wrote books about it. So they're basically a full spectrum replica of sunlight that has a lot of blue. And that actually helps your brain to be in that active day mode, productive mode. It's not the kind of mood lighting, right? The mood lighting is the old incandescent lighting, the lighting that's more yellowish. And that's what you want 2 or 3 hours before bedtime, because that's how your body produces melatonin to get you ready for bed. And when you want to wake up, you do want sunlight, you know, even before the sun rises. The blue light, there's actually cells in your retina that signal your brain, hey, it's time to wake up. It's like daytime, you know. And I think people that get depressed, a lot of times it goes hand in hand with not having that natural light, not having that blue light. So basically you want the full spectrum light that has blue in it during the day. The problem with computers is that they have a lot of blue and basically no in green and no other color. And that's too much. Like, we are not meant to look at this just blue light all day long. And that's why I have a MacBook. So I put night shift mode on my iPhone and my MacBook. It makes it really like orangey yellow looking. But you can use blow blocking glasses. There's software called, I love the software called Iris. It's not free, but it was actually developed by a software developer who noticed his own eyesight getting downhill. And then he studied light and he studied computers. And so he developed the software that's really, that they also have a great blog. Like, if you're interested in blue light and computers, like, read, go to, I don't know, Iris. When you just search for Iris blue light, then you've, yeah, I don't know if it's .com. I forgot what the actual URL is. Yeah. It's awesome. Great.
And when you say full spectrum, is that in reference to the full spectrum of the sun? Is that what that means?
Yeah, I mean that nothing is as good as the sun when it comes to, like, you know, but those daylight lamps, they are, you know, they have that bluish light, but sunlight, we think it's warm because the sun is warm, but the actual light is not that warm. When you take pictures on white, you notice there's a blue hue to that. Yeah, it's cool. Exactly. So, so that's what I'm saying. If you're working, those blue lights, those full spectrum lights that have this whole spectrum, but a lot of blue are good because they keep your brain in that active mode. But once you want to go and chill out, and the fluorescent lights are just, I don't know what the, on the Iris website, it has the spectrum of all the different lights. I can't remember, but they're just, they flicker also. This is another thing with computers. They flicker. It's like, you know, how film is like, what, 25 frames per second because our brain cannot see. So same with the computers. They turn on and off. They have a, I forgot what it's called. 60
hertz or something.
Flicker rate or something. But basically, yeah, it's like basically to conserve battery power. So the computers have this little like rapid in, on and off switch. And then the brain, even though we can't see it, like the, we perceive it somehow. And it also causes strain. So, yeah, that's why. And in the evening, you don't want any blue light because that's when people are like, you know, I can't fall asleep. Or they look at their phones, you know, in the middle of the night. And then it's, I have my phone set to, I'm tricking the system from Apple a little bit because you can't set it to 24 hours. So I set it to 4 a.m. to 3:59 a.m. So it's like 1 minute at night where the light is blue.
I did the same thing. And it's annoying they don't allow us to just have it set for all the time. I'm sure that'd be easy to program. But yeah, anyway. That is a good tool for, you know, it's one thing that we can do to improve our vision. For people that are just finding out about you and the Bates method and this alternative model of improving vision, where do you suggest that they start? Are, you know, of course they can go to your website and I understand you have a course, but what are some resources that you might recommend to people?
So yeah, basically my website, myholisticvision.com, there's also a download that you can get called 10 Habits for Happy, Healthy Eyes. I have a Facebook group. Once you download that thing, you get on my email list and then you will also be invited to my Facebook group and I run a lot of free challenges. Otherwise, I don't have the books right here, but the original Bates Method book is good. Perfect Sight Without Glasses. You can get a reprint. It's from 1920. Wow. It's exactly 100 years old. That's why we did that that documentary that's coming out. I don't have a URL yet for that. There's a lot of good books out there. Aldous Huxley wrote a really great book in 1940 because he was helped by the Bates Method.
A different one?
No, it's called The Art of Seeing. That's the book he wrote in gratitude to the Bates Method. And he never regained 20/20 vision. He had like serious eye diseases as a kid and... But he wasn't even able to see with glasses at that point. So he was really grateful to be able to see. And he has a more eloquent way of describing things as a writer. But it's written in 1940, so he calls the practices drills. But there's a lot of, I mean, Jacob Lieberman's book, and Lieberman is spelled with just an I, is a good resource. There's lots of things you can find online. Central-fixation.com is a website where you can find all the archives of Bates's work for free online. What else? Sure. I mean, there's a lot of different things you can
find.
But
and
yeah.
For people that are looking potentially to work with you, where can they learn more about your work?
So yeah, my website is a starting point. They can also get that same freebie or free gift when they go to www.naturallyclearvision.com and then /10 as in 10 habits. And when you download it from there on the thank you page, there's an invitation for a consultation with me. That's free. It's a complimentary consultation. That would be a way to get in contact with me, get on my email list. As I said, I'm doing lots of free things. I have a monthly membership called the Clear Vision Club. I have an online program that I just finished the fourth time with great success. I'm launching it again in the fall. I don't have the dates yet. And I also have a mentorship program and private coaching. So there's lots of different opportunities at all kind of investment levels, depending on your chart. Because people are like, what is 1 hour with you? I'm like, I really want to talk about your goals and your challenge and then figure out what the best solution is for you moving
forward. Yeah, because
it's
customized for each person.
Exactly. And you can always start for free. I mean, I started with a book and that was written in the 70s. Most people only get so far on their own. But that's a great way to get started. And I always say, see for yourself. Like, don't believe the eye doctor. Don't believe me. Just do it, like do those things and see for yourself if things change, absolutely. Right? Like you did, right?
Excellent. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for sharing all of your wisdom today. It's been wonderful to chat with you and see you again. And yeah, I hope folks listening have a chance to check out your website and learn more about your work and all the great things that you're doing. And you can expect to hear from us again in a few weeks on A Life Economy. Thank you everyone so much for tuning in. This has been a great time. Thank you, Claudia.